hard-hitting medical truth, cutting through conflict and confusion to the understanding you're searching for. Join Dr. Peter McCullough, world-renowned medical expert and practicing physician, for this edition of the McCullough Report. Your life may depend on it.
Let's get real, let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report, and I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. It's been another busy week in the news cycle with respect to COVID-19, the Delta variant, the current outbreak, and the pressing series of events with respect to the COVID-19 vaccine and vaccine mandates. In a nutshell, what we have is we have a series of vaccines in the United States, Pfizer, Moderna, and J&J, that were all coding for a spike protein, the original spike protein of the virus, which is now extinct. The virus has mutated several times, and now we are dominated by the Delta variant that has sufficiently mutated to have what's called antigenic escape. It's escaping the effect of the vaccines. Additionally, we've had analyses come forward showing that the vaccines themselves have a time duration to them, and then after about 6 months, the immunity from the vaccines begins to wane, and that immunity is now coded against a spike protein that is no longer in existence. So we're in free fall with respect to vaccine failure. There's been a doubling down of regulatory authorities across the world to try to vaccinate our way out of this in the middle of this panic of failed vaccinations and a rise in the Delta variant. So I wanted to be careful with you and give you the data with respect to where we have information fairly on those vaccinated and not vaccinated. The first paper is by Dr. Paul Elliott and colleagues from the School of Public Health in the Imperial College of London, United Kingdom. The title of the paper is REACT 1, Round 13, Final Report, Exponential Growth, High Prevalence of SARS-CoV-2 in Vaccine Effectiveness Associated with Delta Variant in England During May to July 2021. What you'll notice in many of these papers, there's almost an incorrect conclusion in the title, in this case, vaccine effectiveness. And in my view, the title should have been vaccine ineffectiveness, and I'll tell you the reason why. In round 13, which is the most recent calendar date to now in this period of time, largely in July, Elliott and colleagues found that 44% of infections occurred in those who were fully vaccinated, and that the vaccine effectiveness was reported to be 49% in individuals using all types of testing combined. Now, in those where the cycle threshold on the PCR was restricted to less than 27, meaning they would have a stronger positive predictive value, the vaccine efficacy rose to 58%. Well, I can tell you with COVID-19, which is potentially a fatal illness, that vaccine effectiveness of 44% or 58% on strong positives is simply not enough to warrant it as a public health reaction to the COVID-19 crisis. The second paper is by Dr. Hetemaki, and the title of that paper is An Outbreak Caused by the SARS-CoV-2 Delta Variant in a Secondary Care Hospital in Finland in May of 2021. And this was published from the Infectious Disease Unit from the Kantaham Central Hospital in Hämeenlinna, Finland, as well as the Translational Immunology Program, the Helsinki University and Helsinki University Central Hospital in Helsinki. This report is concerning because it indicates that this is a domicile facility that's similar to a nursing home or skilled nursing facility. There were 58 case patients that were detected to be positive, and actually 18 died. 11 of them were men. One was vaccinated with two doses, 11 with one dose, and 6 were unvaccinated. So for the majority of patients who died, COVID-19 likely contributed to their death, and the vaccine did not appear to protect them. Of those, there were healthcare workers who became infected. There were 45 healthcare workers to become infected, and there, 21 were unvaccinated, and the other 24 were obviously vaccinated. So the vaccine, at least in that 50-50 split, appeared to have no impact. So this giant crush to have healthcare workers vaccinated appears to, at least from this paper, be ill-fated. The next paper is from the Centers for Disease Control, MMWR, July 30th, 2021. So this is on the CDC website, and it is an outbreak of COVID-19 in Barnstable, Massachusetts. That's a county in Massachusetts. And in this outbreak, there's 469 individuals who developed COVID-19. Two-thirds were fully vaccinated. The next report is on the CDC website, July 26, 2021. Title, Hospitalized or Fatal COVID-19 Vaccine Breakthrough Cases Reported to the CDC as of July 26, 2021. The key thing is cases reported to the CDC. So this isn't everything. This is what happens to get reported to the CDC as breakthrough cases. And this was at a point of 161 Americans that had been vaccinated. The total number of hospitalized or fatal breakthrough cases reported to the CDC was 6,587. 48% of them were female, 74% were over age 65, 19 were asymptomatic infections, so they could have been false positives in the hospital elsewhere, 6,239 resulted in the hospitalizations, and 19% of them died, 1,263. These were all fully vaccinated individuals. Next source of data, the Israeli Health Ministry, data that are related from the Israeli Government Health Data Dashboard that is listed and verified with the Israelis. For the week of July 25th to July 31st, there is a total of 7,370 individuals who developed COVID-19 and were ages 20 to 90 plus. They were fully vaccinated, 7,370. There were 1,502 cases that were unvaccinated. And the percent of cases for that week that were fully vaccinated were 86.1%. So I'm reading these data exactly, and I'm being incredibly careful with this because I want the listeners to understand there are sources of data that are coming in from all over the world, including the United States, where the current sets of vaccines are failing. They are not stopping the occurrence of COVID-19. It's not even clear if they're doing anything once somebody develops COVID-19. Claims that the vaccination reduces the severity or risk of hospitalization with COVID-19 have not been substantiated because they have not accounted for early treatment. We know that early treatment is the only way to reduce the risks of hospitalization and death, including the fully FDA EUA-approved monoclonal antibodies and the use of the Regeneron product. In fact, the Regeneron product reduces hospitalization and death by over 50%. Multiple supportive studies show that. And recently, an innovative study, we're taking a subcutaneous injection of the monoclonal antibody in a large dose in asymptomatic family members prevented the development of COVID-19 in high-risk people when everyone's in the same family and one person has already contracted the virus. So we should really look at good news for early treatment in this immediate of a post-exposure prophylaxis with the Regeneron antibody in terms of research as being positive information. The failure of the vaccines is in a sense a negative wave of information, and it leaves Americans with a lot of questions. Patients are asking me, doctor, which vaccine is failing the worst? Which one is still the best? Well, we know in Israel, where it appears to be in free fall, it's 100% Pfizer. In the UK, it's a blend of Pfizer, Moderna, and AstraZeneca. In the United States, it's Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson. So unless our agencies actually do an analysis of vaccine failure according to the type of vaccine, we simply won't know. And so as people are being pushed into these mandates, some are going to actually accept and do it. They want to make the best choice. And right now, it's a completely uninformed and frightening decision for someone who doesn't want to take the vaccine to begin with. Now, if we transition to vaccine safety, we'll move over to the VAERS report, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System that the CDC provides for us. These are events that have permanent VAERS number, implying the CDC has done some vetting, and in fact, they've occurred at roughly 160 million Americans fully vaccinated. We've had 11,940 deaths, 40,991 hospitalizations, 65,067 urgent care visits, 88,920 office visits, 4,110 cases of anaphylaxis, 37 14 cases of Bell's palsy, which is a form of paralysis of sight of the face, 1,272 miscarriages, 4,799 heart attacks, 3,201 cases of myocarditis or heart inflammation, tends to affect younger individuals, men more than women, 12,808 permanently disabled individuals, 19,032 cases of thrombocytopenia or low platelets, 11,109 cases of life-threatening events, 22,286 cases of severe allergic reactions, and 6,123 cases of tinnitus, or this burdensome burning and ringing in the ears. I can tell you at these numbers, if there was a diabetes medicine that was widely used in the United States, if we had these numbers, the diabetes medicine would be off the market at 50 deaths. We would never have amounted this magnitude of safety events with respect to the COVID-19 vaccine. And our agencies should have been having weekly, if not monthly, safety reviews. They should have told Americans in whom these safety events are occurring and why. How can we reduce the risks? Which vaccine is more safe than others? In fact, there's been no information given to individuals. They've been simply told that the vaccines are safe and effective. And even our CDC appears to be in free fall in terms of their messaging. So we do have a CDC recognition of what was shown in a paper by Fahrenholt and colleagues several weeks ago, that in fact, the vaccine is not stopping the infection. It's not sterilizing for COVID-19, certainly not the Delta variant, and that we're in deep trouble. We have had a singular focus for COVID-19 to get to vaccination. Our federal agencies, the major academic medical centers, the physician groups, mid-level providers have completely and totally dependent on vaccination as the only strategy. They have fundamentally put no efforts into early treatment to reduce hospitalization and death, and inpatient treatment has been minimal and been supportive at best, without much innovation or without much fanfare in terms of improving quality of care in the hospital and shortening the duration of symptoms and shortening length of stay. It hasn't been any fundamental movement on this in over a year. So as we sit here today, we're at a point of crisis. There is a great degree of agony that's sitting at the end of a needle, that Americans now know that the vaccines have failed, they're dangerous, and to make matters worse, what was an elective investigational program, it was research, it was offered by the CDC and FDA, has become public enemy number one, and people are being forced into vaccination to keep their jobs. They're being put under menacing mandates and scrambling to try to come up with medical or religious exemptions. Americans in no way, shape, or form want this vaccine. And they are, well, this is going to be a test of wills to see who is going to be forced into the vaccination, who's going to resist vaccination, and when in the world are we going to get out of this? I do not want to say the word vaccine or vaccination ever the rest of my life. This has been an absolute horrific development in medical care. We are hoping that doctors come out of their trance. Doctors appear to be completely entranced, completely hypnotized with this idea that mass vaccination will deliver us out of the pandemic. Many doctors are frozen in personal fear. They're greatly fearful of COVID-19. I can tell you in my medical center, I was in the hospital all day yesterday. I can't have a single doctor now look me in the eye and have a conversation regarding COVID-19. They are absolutely paralyzed. I can tell when I look at them, I can tell that they know in their subconscious that they are wrong about this. They were wrong about not treating patients early. They're wrong about this forcing mass vaccination on individuals with an unsafe mechanism of action with absolutely terrible outcomes. And now we know the vaccine doesn't even work. It doesn't even have the therapeutic effect that we'd want to see with COVID-19. So we couldn't be in a more tense situation. We have, our phones are ringing off the hook with more and more patients becoming ill. We're doing the best we can to help them out. The Delta variant does appear to be more contagious. I have looked at the reports very carefully, and it's my clinical understanding now, really seeing this evolve in my practice, that it clearly is transmissible. Fortunately, patients who have natural immunity, it's robust, complete, and durable. And during the reports of vaccine breakthroughs, we had 10,000 vaccine breakthroughs up until May reported by the CDC, and now this additional 6,000 individuals who are hospitalized or died that broke through the vaccine. With as large number of vaccine breakthroughs, during that same time point, there was not a single case of natural immunity breakthrough reported or published on the CDC website. And that's been my experience. Once patients have natural immunity, it's robust, complete, and durable. There is a substantial library of antibodies, IgG, initially IgM, IgA in the nasopharyngeal tract and secretory organs. We know we have T helper cells, T presenter cells, natural killer cells, macrophages, plasma cells. All have been keyed and ready to identify many antigens or many aspects of SARS-CoV-2. No matter how mutated it is, our natural immunity will prevent a second infection. An analysis by Mirtu and colleagues from 11 separate papers, 615,000 individuals, even in poorly defined and poorly captured initial cases, the chances of COVID-19 over the next year are 0.2%. I can tell you, as you're listening to this, if you've had COVID-19 and you've recovered, your immunity will carry you through. There's not a single study showing that the vaccine can benefit a patient who has natural immunity. Not a single study. And there are three studies, one by Ra, Kammer, and Mathudius, that show that vaccination on top of natural immunity is related to higher serious adverse safety events, and including in one paper, hospitalization. So a naturally immune individual should fill out a strong exemption for vaccination, and one should know there's no opportunity for benefit and only an opportunity for harm. We can clearly clean up some of the safety issues in the program if we'll stop having vaccination of people who don't need it. Now, we have a terrific show for you this week, and a real treat and pleasure to invite to the show Dr. Hector Carvalho, and he's from Buenos Aires in Argentina. And one of the things I've done in the McCullough Report is try to give you a window to the outside world, because the media right now in the United States is giving no viewpoint of what's going on in the outside world. Dr. Carvalho is a national hero. He's innovated with early treatment protocols, done a tremendous amount of work with ivermectin, very versatile intracellular anti-infective when used early, also useful when it's used late in the hospital. And it's a real pleasure to have him on. He's a senior physician and well-respected throughout the country of Argentina. It's also a great pleasure to ask to the studio Dr. Paul Corona. And that's right, his last name is Corona. You can't have a better name right now in the middle of the pandemic. Paul is a family physician in California, but he's trained and done extensive work in psychiatry and actually does mainly family psychiatry. And he's going to give us a review of three books he's published that largely help doctors and patients understand various common psychiatric and behavioral problems. And then he's going to move into the mass psychology and psychiatric illness that's developing as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. So why don't you sit back, strap in, and let's get real, let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report. Let's get real, let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report. Are you tired, fatigued, worried about COVID-19 coming your way? We're in the middle of the Delta pandemic, and I can tell you that we really need our vitamins. Immune Super Boost by Healthy Cell is a wonderful way to get pill-free vitamins in a convenient gel pack. It's instantaneous delivery, it tastes good, and it's a wonderful blend of exactly what we need to boost our immune system during this next outbreak of the Delta variant in the United States. So go to HealthyCell.com, and you can use the promotional code OUTLOUD to get a discount on your first order. Let's get real, let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Because of COVID-19, the average American worries about their immune health four times a day. That's 112 times per year. To minimize the worries, leading nutritional supplement company, Healthy Cell, created Immune Super Boost, an immune supplement that contains 15 full doses of science-backed nutrients like vitamin C, zinc, elderberry, and echinacea, all in a one-a-day pill-free gel pack. It tastes great, is convenient on the go, and it's more natural too, without chemical binders, fillers, and coatings. Supporting a strong and resilient immune system can be simple. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of Immune Super Boost. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report, and I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. Today's guest on the show is Dr. Hector Carvalho. Dr. Carvalho attended his university at the University of Buenos Aires in Buenos Aires, Argentina. He ultimately became a professor of medicine at the same institution, trained in internal medicine and endocrinology, and he served really a long and distinguished career there. He is in medical retirement, but he really has focused on COVID-19 pandemic and the early treatment. And so I wanted to bring him on the show to give us some important insights from South America so Americans can have a window of how the pandemic is being approached elsewhere in the world. Dr. Carvalho, welcome to the McCullough Report.
Thank you, Dr. McCullough. It's a pleasure.
Well, tell us how you got involved in the global pandemic.
Well, I may say that as everybody else, without willing to, but the fact is, at the early stages of the pandemic, and even before it appeared in Argentina, we were trying to train all the doctors that were in the front line, that is in the trench, in order to learn what was going on in the rest of the world. And so we prepared summaries of all the works that we could get in the journals in order to keep them trained on what they were going to face in a very short time. And we had already come across the studies on ivermectin as a virucidal compound a few years ago, because of it has been proved to be effective on dengue fever, and dengue is endemic in Argentina, so we were acquainted with those works. But when the first works appeared on ivermectin against COVID-19, that was in Melbourne University, in the Monash University in Australia, we got that article that had not been even published, but we got the idea, and we replicated what they had done in vitro, but we did it in vivo with the healthcare workers and with the patients. The first one for prevention, that is for pre-exposure appliance, and the second one for treatment. The first one was applied to healthcare workers in two public hospitals in Argentina, one in Buenos Aires and one in the outskirts of Buenos Aires, in the suburb of Buenos Aires City. And the first one, the prophylaxis, was applied initially together with carrageenan, which is another compound that is used in the nostrils and in the mouth, that is in one hospital, and with ivermectin alone in the other hospital. Those were called the IverCar and the IverPrev trial, respectively. And talking about treatment, we started using it as an early treatment, not alone, but together with aspirin for the mild cases and together with corticosteroids for the moderate and severe cases, in which we replaced the aspirin by enoxaparin. You may say, well, wait a minute, corticoids have proved to be effective on ivermectin. That's true, but we started doing that in early April 2020, that is far before the recovery trial was released, because it didn't have to be a genius to realize that part of the problem was because of the virus, and the worst part was because of the hyperinflammatory situation that was provoked by the endothelitis and by the cytokine storm. And you had to work to count on an immune modulator in order to prevent both situations. Otherwise, the patient will get worse, and the sooner we treated the patient, the better. Which I'm saying is the ABC of medicine. I can't by now, I can't realize how medical doctors can accept the fact that they are told that they have to do nothing until the patient cannot breathe. That is person abandonment. And early treatment has always, always proved to be far better than late treatment in any disease with any compound. So doing nothing and remaining arm folded until the patient finds it difficult to breathe, that's not only unethical, that's criminal.
You know, Dr. Covello, in the United States, as we sit here today, the National Institutes of Health still advises no treatment until the patient comes in the hospital, and even then no treatment, only until the patient requires oxygen. And at that point in time, my understanding is the patient has microthrombosis. That's far beyond the virus. So have you made any progress in Argentina? Have you made progress with early treatment?
I may say that not as much as we wanted, because as Argentina's sanitary authorities are following the WHO directions, like a blind person follows another blind person, only a few provinces in Argentina have authorized ivermectin officially, because Argentina is divided into provinces, like the United States is divided into states. So just a few, five provinces have authorized ivermectin, which, by the way, are the ones which are doing better with in terms of contagions and deaths. But even they have half to one-fifth of the incidence of contagions and death than the rest of the country, even in this condition, in this situation, ivermectin has not been allowed in the whole country. So there are so many real life proofs, like the ones that I mentioned, a part of Argentina, like Mexico City, like India, that prove us right, and yet we are not allowed to use it massively, because the problem is beyond ivermectin, because ivermectin is not the only compound that works. Hydroxychloroquine is very useful. Vitamin D in high doses is also useful. Azithromycin is useful. Doxycycline is useful. Combinations between them are even more effective than isolated compounds. But yet, the problem is not that. The problem is that if any of this treatment is accepted worldwide, the precarious permission for vaccines will be in danger. We have never tried to match the efficacy of vaccines. We have never said it is ivermectin or vaccines. We have always said it's ivermectin and vaccines. But the manufacturers feel that they are in danger if any compound is accepted to be useful as treatment. That's why we have been violently opposed all this time, because of greed and nothing but greed and profits. It's not a scientific field in which we are battling now. And the virus itself is the weakest of our enemies. So that's why we are a little bit discouraged by now.
Do you have a sense that indeed the government and the other stakeholders for the vaccine, are they intentionally denying patients treatment in order to force the vaccine on the population?
I have no doubt about that. I'm 100% positive about that, because they cannot be so stupid. Because I understand that we must not consider that intention is the only reason, because stupidity may be another reason. But after a year and a half, after so many proofs all over the world, after so many trials, and I'm not talking about ivermectin, but all the other compounds that I mentioned before, it's not a matter of stupidity. It's a matter of crime.
Do you feel that even the medical literature, the medical journals and the citation indexes, do you think that they are also now corrupt and they're not fairly publishing papers on early treatment and also promoting the vaccine?
Well, I may tell you my experience. We have so far published, apart from the trials that we duly submitted to the National Library of Medicine in the United States of America, we have released 14 articles, but not a single one in a first class, say, let's say, first class journal. All in peer-reviewed journals, but open access journals that accepted them, because we were refused. The first study that we performed and that had been accepted at the National Library of Medicine, we tried to publish it at the Journal of American Medical Association, and we were told by the editor-in-chief that it was not interesting. Not interesting when people were dying like flies. Not interesting. Well, I believe the more important a magazine or a journal is, the more sponsors it needs to keep alive. And there's no dog that bites the hand that feeds him, is there?
Yes, I have to tell you, even a trial like Cold Corona of colchicine, over 4,000 patients, multi-center, prospective, double-blind, placebo, randomized controlled trial, even that trial was delayed and then rejected at New England Journal of Medicine, delayed and rejected at JAMA, delayed and rejected at Lancet, and then went to a lower level Lancet journal 6 months later. Can you imagine a quality trial of that size not seeing the light of day for 6 months, denying important information?
I knew that, Dr. McAuliffe, and it doesn't surprise me because I have suffered the same. It doesn't surprise me. That's why I cannot accept stupidity as a reason for doing so. That cannot be accepted anymore.
But it seems so global and it seems so pervasive and ironclad. It's through every walk of life, every employer, every school, every medical journal, every medical school. It's all about one thing, to promote and force the vaccine on people who don't want it and to deny them early treatment for a really treatable illness.
Yes, you are right. I've followed most of your presentations and I cannot agree more than 100%. No university has done anything, but it's not a conspiracy theory, because for a conspiranoic point of view, you have to have 193 countries deciding all together to do the same thing at the same time. And I have not seen in my 64 years, I have never seen 193 countries thinking the same and doing the same on any reason. It's a matter of 7 or 8 laboratories in the world, because the more powerful a country is, the more powerful its pharmaceutical industry will be. So it's a matter of 4, 5, 6 big pharma companies deciding to do something, and they can buy the will of the medical journals, the will of the media. They have the money to do so. They have far more money than we can imagine. You know, the trials we have done, we have spent not a single coin in doing that, because we begged for free samples to do so. We didn't spend the money. Now we are trying to make a new trial with 120 patients, 60 patients that had received ivermectin for the last year and a half, and 60 patients that had been vaccinated, and in both cases, in both arms, patients that have not have not had the disease, at least in which the COVID had not been found as a disease. So they had passed asymptomatic all the time. And we wanted to study the humoral and the cellular response in both cases. I mean, asymptomatic patients on both arms. And for that, there is a matter of a little money to do so. We cannot get a sponsor because all the sponsors say, no, if it is against the vaccines, we are not trying to match the vaccines. We are trying to prove our point.
There seems to be just a overwhelming message that anything goes potentially against the vaccines, that it's not allowed. And you're right, early treatment is completely complementary to vaccines if they were safe and effective. Dr. Carvalho, this has been a terrific interview. Do you have any final words for the American audience?
Well, yes. If you don't mind, I'd like to remind all the medical audience that we have made a Hippocratic oath, all of us, all of us, all over the world. It is the same oath, or more or less the same oath, all over the world. And we have not sworn, we have sworn on Apollo, Hygieia, and all the Greek gods and goddesses. But we haven't made an oath, we haven't sworn on Pfizer or Moderna or whatever. And we have decided to be doctors to do something for our patients, not to remain arm folded. That if we consider that remaining arm folded is the best we can do in the middle of a pandemic, we should think twice if we are good doctors.
Well, I'll tell you, I'll let that be the last word. You've heard from Dr. Hector Carvalho in Buenos Aires, Argentina, about pandemic response in South America. And I tell you, we have a long way to go. Patients have been denied treatment and been railroaded into a mass vaccination program. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Carvalho, for joining us on the McCullough Report.
Thanks to you, Doctor.
Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report.
The America Out Loud family is comprised of patriots in the true sense of the word. We know that if America fails, the world will fail. It is incumbent upon us to carry the torch for liberty and the Constitution to help save America for future generations to come. AmericaOutloud.com. It's a fight for the soul of humanity.
Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is a McCullough Report, and I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. I'm here today with Dr. Paul Corona. Paul received his undergraduate degree from the University of California and then went on to medical school at the New York Medical College. He returned to California at California Medical Center in Los Angeles and trained in family practice. And since launching into family practice, he really has had a central focus on adult psychiatry, family issues with respect to psychology. And he's published a series of important books that I want him to introduce to the audience. And then we're going to go into application of some important principles of psychology, particularly group psychology, as it relates to the COVID-19 pandemic. Paul, welcome to the McCullough Report.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you for having me on.
Well, let's launch into the first book, Healing the Mind and Body One. Tell us about that book and what can the readers look forward to?
Well, it got about me a little bit of background. So I started in family practice in 1992. And at the time, I was interested in different parts of medicine in residency or in medical school, which is why I chose family medicine. I thought it'd be just a mixture of everything. But I enjoyed psychiatry. I enjoyed internal medicine, OBGYN. But I didn't think I wanted to do any of those things full time. So at the time when I was in residency, we had three antidepressants out, the modern ones, Prozac, Zoloft, and Paxil, all SSRIs, you know, medications that focus on serotonin. So, but when I got out in practice in 1993, the first medication called Effexor XR came out, which is a dual action medication that balances also norepinephrine. When I started seeing the noradrenergic effects of that medication throughout the 90s, I was in shock because I saw people's physical ailments getting better. I started seeing less side effects, better focus, better everything, better anxiety reduction. And so then I was wondering why I wasn't hearing about this more. I was doing lecturing about it, but doctors weren't picking it up. And so I was curious. So I read a couple psychiatric textbooks during the 90s, cover to cover, trying to figure out, you know, why what I was seeing wasn't really being taught and wasn't being talked about. And so just even a basic thing, like most psychiatrists believe that SSRIs are the best first line medications, but I started really realizing that SNRIs are better. And I started wondering why, when doctors said it would take four to six, 8 weeks for an antidepressant to work. And I was seeing results within a week or two. So things like that just really started to, I started questioning everything. And around the year 2000 is when I just decided I was getting so busy doing so much psychiatry that I didn't have much time for family medicine anymore because I was getting a lot of referrals and doing a lot of speaking. So I decided to go full-time into psychiatry around the year 2000. So anyway, leading to the first book, so in 2002, about 2 years after I started doing that, I really got to the point where I realized that I wasn't seeing what I was learning out there. And in the journals, in the books, anywhere, when I went to lectures. So I decided, you know, I need to start writing. And so that's what started me prompting me to write the first book, which really at the time I was, who was my audience? Well, I thought, you know, patients, doctors, whatever. I didn't really know. So I started. And then when I started realizing during writing that it was really too long for one book, so I had to make two books out of it. So I thought I would just do the first book for patients and then the second book for doctors. And then the second book led to getting too long also. So then I decided to split that into another book. So I thought, okay, the second book will be for doctors and patients, and the third book will be for doctors. So that's what kind of led to the three book series that I wrote over 12 years, and it's 1,200 pages total. So it became a lot of material, but that's kind of my initial thinking when it came to the books when they're coming out.
So the listener can find Dr. Corona's books that are called Healing the Mind and Body, books 1, 2, and 3, and they are a progression. The first one is the general book for the general reader. The second one is the doctor and patient guide. And then the third one is the continuation of the doctor and patient guide. And these books, I have to tell you, are impressive. They are have very detailed tables of contents, which really tells the reader that they're extremely well organized. They are about 400 to 500 pages. So they are extensive, but I think these types of concepts are terribly important. And, you know, one of the great goals of psychology that I understand as a general internist and cardiologist is to develop the skill or the aptitude of insight, that is to see within someone. And I can tell you, Dr. Corona is shaking his head right now, yes, that this idea of developing insight. And so when I looked over his books, I was asking myself, what's really being accomplished in these chapters? And certainly it's learning a lot of terms. It's learning a lot of core concepts. And then, of course, important things for that patients need to know. But I think a lot of it has to do with developing insight. Okay, terrific. Paul, any more comments regarding the books? I know it's really been a trilogy for you, a labor of love. All textbooks are a labor of love. How do the listeners find your books?
Well, they go on my website, drpaulcoronamd.com, at DR for doctor. But yeah, the first book, I really try to teach patients and then doctors also the kind of the technology of how psychotropic medications work. And I talk about depression, bipolar disorder, eating disorders. And then there was, you know, didn't have enough really time to address anxiety disorder. So that was really my second book. I focused on anxiety disorder, managing stress, and also trying to train people to have patients learn how to get the information to the doctors that the doctor needs to make these decisions. And as a family doctor, also, I've been, my focus is on the physical and emotional. So fibromyalgia, you know, a lot of, as you know, a lot of people go to the ER with chest pain, with palpitations, and that ends up being stress. And, you know, all the physical symptoms, headaches, neck and shoulder, all fibromyalgia, IBS, all these things that are, have been a mystery over the years of medicine. I think the mystery is because they're stress related and they're actually all completely treatable. And these medications are pretty amazing how they work and how safe and effective they are.
So yeah, it sounds like you're a proponent of both cognitive behavioral therapy as well as pharmacotherapy together.
Absolutely. And, you know, I work a lot with therapists. I think all the studies show that therapy plus medications is better than either alone.
That's terrific. So, Paul, let's turn our attention to the COVID-19 pandemic. What are you seeing on the ground now? So we're coming up on a year and a half into this. We're now into a wave of the Delta variant. So we're on our first substantial rise in cases in the mass vaccination era. What are you seeing on the ground in terms of patient difficulties and their perceptions of what's going on?
Oh, it's been a horrible, horrible year and a half. And I've been, you know, back in March, I have a podcast, the Dr. Paul Show, and I recently released my 70th, 74th one on all about the subject, about the pandemic, the vaccines, the, you know, early treatment. But I was talking about it back in my podcast in March of 2020, and really seeing that things were going already very badly with the shutdowns and all the school closure stuff. And I was listening to you and Dr. Rich, Dr. Bhattacharya, and Dr. Atlas, all these, you know, you all, I've been listening to you guys all year about, you know, early treatment. And I've been trying to get the word out with my patients on the podcast. And I think that it's, the whole thing has just been a disastrous year. And, you know, and I, obviously all the medical problems we've seen because of, you know, like you, I heard you said, you know, people not getting their cath lab appointments, people not getting vaccine, people not getting screening for cancer. So from a medical standpoint, it was disastrous, but from a psychiatric standpoint, it's been horrible. The overdose deaths over the last year, 960,000 overdose deaths, 60% fentanyl, and the suicide rate in kids also, also teenagers, spousal abuse, child abuse, people being locked together for too long, and that's not healthy. And so, yeah, I've never seen as bad of a year, and my practice has never been busier for this reason. The anxiety and the paranoia about this virus has been just way over the top. And I think we missed a huge opportunity. I think why are so many doctors so blind to this? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't understand. But when I talk to them, they just don't, when I tell them, you know, there's early treatment, they look at me like, what? You know, there is? I go, yeah, there's some really good early treatment, and doctors just don't know about it. And I guess because of the fact that, you know, they can't get that information, or they hear the mainstream media and they don't know where to listen to for advice, and they just follow the public health department recommendations. I think doctors are like a lot of people are sheep, and they just follow along the crowd and do what they're told and not question. And as scientists, I mean, are you kidding me? We as scientists should be saying no. What's going on is wrong, and there's, thankfully, there's a lot of us who feel that way, but I think there's the majority of the doctors out there unfortunately don't think this way.
But Paul, I think it's more than just lack of knowledge. I mean, I've had doctors come up to me and I've talked to them and I said, you know, it's treatable early, and I've never had a doctor say, wow, I didn't know that, I'll start doing it right away, I'll start treating right away. Never. I get a confused look. They're kind of in a trance, in a daze. They're frightened. And there may be a couple little exchanges, and then they'll just, or they'll pick a lightning rod medicine. Oh, you mean hydroxychloroquine? I said, no. I said, I mean the whole program. I personally think the steroids and blood thinners do more. And then they're like, they kind of look at me like, oh,
Like, so there's something in their minds, in these doctors' minds, where they're confused, they're fearful. They try to be dismissive. They pick a lightning rod like hydroxychloroquine and then try to dismiss the whole thing. There's something in the minds of doctors where their minds have kind of turned to mush when it comes to treatment. They just absolutely are failing miserably. Yet the same doctors, if you mention the word vaccine, oh my gosh, they just sharpen up and they want to make sure everyone's vaccinated, and they're just on an absolute agenda to make sure everybody is vaccinated.
It's madness. And I've been trying and feeling desperate because, you know, time is running short and people are being forced into this. And I just get sad when a patient tells me they've had it when they're young and healthy. And so I'm trying to tell as many people as I can to save as many people as possible to tell them no, or not to just tell them no, but tell them why no. I explain to patients, you know, this is why you should say no to these drugs. And but I feel sad the fact that, you know, so much time has been lost and that so many lives have been lost, unfortunately, because of the lost message of early treatment. And and I don't know, I think we're going to look back after this calamity. I think it'll be the biggest calamity in the history of mankind, and doctors I think are going to feel guilty and start to feel like when they come out of the trance, what have we done, what did we do to people? It's going to hit the fan later. And when it does, I think there's a reckoning that's going to happen. But it's too bad, because I think it didn't have to be this way. It really didn't.
Yeah. Many doctors, what I learned is so many doctors are susceptible to almost a mass hypnosis. And I think the main stimulus for the hypnotism was fear, that they were fearful of themselves that they would get the illness and got into a cycle. It was almost masterfully done. Whoever is the perpetrator behind this, and maybe there is no perpetrator, maybe this is just a naturally occurring thing that it's a quirk of human history, but it could have been intentional. It looks like certainly some elements of COVID-19 were intentional. That the idea, I was so shocked at how susceptible physicians were. It was almost as if our physicians would be terrible on the field of battle. If we had a war tomorrow and we were invaded and we needed doctors to step up and make some decisions and, you know, put some gauze in a wound, you know, they would step back and say, wait a minute, is there a large randomized trial? Does the CDC say I can do this? Are there guidelines that tell me I can manage it this way? Doctors, suddenly they had the complete and total inability to use any clinical judgment. They needed large clinical trials that they knew were nowhere close to being done. And then they needed authority figures like public health, like, for instance, the CDC doesn't give treatment guidelines. Neither does the NIH by and large, and neither does the FDA. So they started looking to these organizations to give treatment guidelines, and the whole thing became an absolute mess. And as we sit here today, we're on the rise in terms of cases. The medical centers are continuing to be as inept as possible, even though the data is so much better. You know, there are data now showing massive reductions in hospitalization and death with monoclonal antibodies. There's been wonderful trials now in nursing homes. Do you think this would be the buzz that we would get all the nursing homes stocked with these monoclonal antibodies and get going? But there's no mention of it. All we see is morning, noon, and night, the vaccine. In fact, the vaccine being linked to employment, being linked to freedoms, going to school. Everything is about the vaccine. I've never heard the word vaccine mentioned so much, and then in the last year.
Yeah, and the thing about the CDC, the WHO, none of them see patients. None of them put a stethoscope on a chest. None of them have, you know, when do you ever hear any data coming out of Dr. Fauci? I haven't heard one. Anything like, at least like, oh, hey, maybe take some vitamin D this fall or anything. I mean, there's nothing there. And it's just all that he taught. They all talk around. And again, a lot of them are either, some of them are doctors, some of them aren't. And that's all they do is public health. And so either they're right, or people like you and me and the people, the scientists who actually see patients and treat COVID, and maybe it's either we're right or they're right. You know who I'm betting on?
Well, it's if we're wrong, Paul, we must have lost our minds at this point. And it's possible, you know, we heard that the Federation of State Medical Boards is going to start hunting down people's licenses regarding COVID misinformation. So who decides information versus misinformation? And I've been so tight about citing the literature when I go on national TV and webcasts and podcasts, partly out of fear that I could be accused of spreading misinformation. So when it comes down to a defense of a medical license, and I said, well, I mentioned this author, here's the paper that I mentioned, I'm hoping that there'll be some justice somewhere, but I'm really worried about justice. You know, as we sit here today, all the cases of mass vaccination, as an example, going on where people have lost their jobs. And again, for the listeners to understand, we understand this vaccine doesn't work completely. In fact, it may not work at all. And it is grossly unsafe for indiscriminate use. That so far, all the cases, Houston Methodist, Indiana University, all of them actually have been decided in favor of mass vaccination. We only heard word this week that the LA Independent School District backed off on mass vaccination of children.
Well, I mean, we're going to see, again, this is going to be also going to be the biggest study of all time. We're going to have half the country vaccinated, half of the country unvaccinated. So we're going to see in the coming months, in a year or two, 3 years, you know, what's going to happen to the study group. And basically, unfortunately, the study group are the people who got vaccinated because there were no good studies to go by. So they're it. And I'm just, you know, I've already seen in my practice and I've heard from many other people about already people having problems. And I've heard of several, a handful of deaths in my area because of it. I've heard, you know, I talked to a woman there the other day. She's had rashes coming and going. She said she's been tired, foggy, you know, ever since the vaccination two months ago. And then she went to her, and she'd been having so many problems. She went to her family doctor, and the family doctor said, well, he urged her to get the second one. And I said, no. She goes, no, I'm not going to get the second one. I go, but my family wants me to. So even though she's telling people all these problems she has from the vaccine, they're still urging her to get the second one. It's just, it's craziness.
Well, Paul, this has been a great interview. Do you have any final comments for the McCullough Report audience?
No, just thank you for you and the other doctors out there. Really appreciate you know, meeting you and have learned so much from you and the other doctors that you work with. And I just hope we just get the word out there. We need to do as much as we can as quickly as possible. Like I said, time's wasting. We need to try to shut this vaccine, these experimental drugs down as soon as possible. I mean, and so that's, you know, all we can do is the best we can do. But thank you very much, Dr. McCullough, for having me on.
Oh, terrific. And Paul, how can our listeners follow you?
Well, the Dr. Paul Show, that the Dr. Paul Show is on Apple, iTunes, Spotify. I'm doing my 75th one next week. They're all about a half hour. And then my website, Dr. Paul, so drpaulcoronamd.com. And my books are available there. They're on sale. I include shipping. I'll personalize them. And there's a lot of other things on the website too.
Well, Paul, I have to encourage you, with your last name being Corona,
yeah.
The coronavirus 19 disaster for a year and a half, you have got to write a book about psychological implications of COVID-19.
Yeah, well, I'm writing. I don't run out of time, but I wrote my fourth and fifth book already. My sixth book is coming out within the next year, called The Corona Protocol. And so I'm looking forward to, and we'll talk more about that later, Dave.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to it. Thank you so much for joining us on the McCullough Report.
Thank you.
Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report.